everybody. Welcome back to another episode of To Be Determined with Dan and Bill.
And today we're going to have a tribute to building codes. And if you wonder what that means, it will be made clear eventually.
Yes, exactly. So what's the story that we have on tap for today, Dan?
This is There Will Come Soft Rains, a very famous story by Ray Bradbury, which originally was published in May of 1950 in Collier's Magazine, but also was simultaneously published in his great book, The Martian Chronicles. However, it also appears that this story has been revised and was revised back in 1997. So if you're looking for it, there's going to be at least two different versions.
You know, we've talked off and on since we started this podcast of doing stories or a story somewhere by Bradbury, and we would start reviewing them and we would go down the rabbit hole.
He's got so many things that are out there that are worth covering. So yeah, it's really hard to make a decision.
That's right. And they're all over the map. It's just one of those things where, because we were on this sort of disaster arc, this one just sort of popped up and waved at us and said, hey, pick me. And so here we are finally covering Bradbury. And There Will Come Soft Rains is a post-apocalyptic kind of story in and of itself. And it fits in with our little arc that we're exploring here.
Absolutely. I mean, anybody who's been around science fiction knows Bradbury, right? I mean, I remember watching, what was the name of this show? The Ray Bradbury Theater? Yeah, that's what it was. Back in the 80s and I think the early 90s, there was like five or six seasons of it. And I think they covered like 60 or 70 of his stories. I don't think this was one of them, though.
I don't remember this being part of that. And I saw many of them.
Yeah, I don't think it would be very easy to make an episode of this story since there's really no characters.
Right.
Kind of hard to have a TV short film or anything about something with no characters.
It's hard to keep people focused on a story where the main character is the house.
Yes. So, yeah, jumping ahead to the grand list of characters in this story, it is even shorter than normal. I mean, we're very used to all these short stories having a few characters, but this one, in fact, has absolutely none.
I suppose, in addition to the house, we could do something like, say, there are cleaning robots that look like mice, and there's an incinerator in the basement, and there's a house computer, but that would be really stretching it and pushing it. It's all connected to the house. And it is one of the first stories that I read, at least. Not necessarily one of the first stories that depicts a smart house, but it's certainly one of the first ones that I ever encountered.
It is true that in many respects, the house itself is anthropomorphized, right? And this is actually much more prevalent in the revised edition of the story than it is in the first 1950 edition of the story. But you'll get a sense that the house is almost treated like a living being in some respects in what it's doing, and it's got its little daily routine, and it's got its list of things to do, and it's doing them to the best of its ability. But again, at the end of the day, it's just a smart house, and not even necessarily what we would call a smart house, right? It's more of an automated house.
Right. I was actually going to say that, because all of the events that play out in the story are built not around the house's routines, but around the house's routines that are set up to augment or to serve human routines.
So starting out, right, as Bill just said, we have all these automated routines. And the first story, or at least the first edition of the story, describes the house as being, fairly typical. It was built, I think, in 1980. It's got all the modern day features and everything else. And then almost immediately, a nearby nuclear strike is described as 10,000 explosions, red fire in the sky, and a rain of ashes and radioactivity. So pretty clear from the outset what's going on.
The story opens with the clock beginning, or the clock, with the house beginning one of its routines that includes the voice clock, where it says it sings to the people of the house that are no longer there. Tick tock, 7 o'clock, time to get up, 7 o'clock. It says, as if it were afraid that nobody would listen.
Yep, and it's April 28th, 1985 at 7 a.m. And at the same time, of course, the house doing what it is programmed to do, it's you know, it's sounding out the alarm, waking people up, and it starts automatically cooking breakfast. It starts reading out the daily schedule of what everybody is supposed to do over the course of the day. It's go to work, you know, go to school, eat your breakfast, drink your Ovaltine.
It feels a little bit like we're reading an episode of The Jetsons or something like that, where 8 pieces of perfectly brown toast pop out, 8 eggs sunny side up, 16 slices of bacon, 2 coffees, and two cool glasses of milk. The only thing that's missing is Rosie.
A nice light breakfast.
Right. A very hearty American fare kind of stuff.
Now imagine how long the story would be if it was an English breakfast.
Yes, there you go.
It'd probably be like 3 or 4 more hours of descriptions of everything else. Of course, that would probably include blood sausage, and yeah, we probably don't want to go there. Apologies to any British people listening.
Right.
I'm sure you like your blood sausage.
And your Earl Grey.
So anyway, getting back to the story, we've got, so breakfast is being made. Of course, no one eats it. The house automatically cleans up all the dishes, dumps all the food, you know, down the garbage disposal, presumably. 9 o'clock, 9:15 hits, and all these little small cleaning robots, you know, they're described as mice. They come out, they tidy up the house, you know, for whatever dirt happened to accumulate overnight. We move from the inside of the house to the outside. At 10:15 a.m., the sprinklers come on to water, well, whatever's left of the lawn after a nuclear explosion. And then you get the first sort of glimpse of anything resembling humanity.
Right. So on the outside of the house, we see silhouettes burned in ash into the side of the house, or onto the side of the house, rather. So you've got Dad mowing the lawn, Mom in her garden, and 2 kids playing with a ball where the fifth shadow, or the fifth, yeah, I guess it is shadow, is the ball itself. And it's the first evidence that we have in the story of a human element.
Yep. So here we are, these four people going about their normal day. Nuclear explosion hits. Everything's gone, including them, and nothing left but shadows and ashes on the wall.
And so at some point, not too long after, the house continues to go about its business, doing things, and the dog shows up on the front porch, and it's starving, and it's shivering, and it's covered in sores, and it whines on the porch. And it's interesting because the house recognizes that it's the dog, opens the door, the dog comes in, tracks mud across the living room, goes running around through the house looking for people, goes upstairs, barks at all the doors, which are closed, eventually finds a place to kind of huddle up and just sort of runs around in a dead panic. Well, dead panic. Yeah, it runs around in a panic until...
Well, it's also panicking because at the same time, the house is cooking lunch and the dog can smell lunch being cooked. And it's, you know, can't get through the kitchen door to get to all, I think it's pancakes or something like that. So it's trying to get the pancakes. It's starving. It can't get to them because for some reason the kitchen door is closed, which seems odd. I don't have a door to my kitchen. I don't know of anybody else who does, but I don't know. In the 1950 version, I guess older houses still had kitchens with doors on them.
In the 1997 version, that element is missing, where the dog does not, it's not looking for the lunch. That's an interesting difference.
Yes. So in my version, at least, the dog can't get to the food, and it eventually, of course, you know, starves to death, dies in the middle of the house, to the great consternation of the small cleaning robots who eventually, about an hour later, come up, pick up the dead dog, take it downstairs to the family incinerator, and poof, no more dog. And that's the only living creature that we meet in the entire story.
Everybody needs their own incinerator in the basement.
They do. And it's funny because one of the other things they talk about with the incinerator is that, well, all the things in the house, really, they compare the house to an altar with
right.
9,000 attendants serving gods that no longer exist.
Yes, and it compares the incinerator to a demon huddling in the corner.
Yeah, and you see, that's not in my version of the story, so there are some significant writing differences between the two. But anyway, later on, as the day progresses, more of these automated processes kick off. The house sets up bridge tables and pours martinis for people. It fills up bathtubs and provides razors for people to shave with.
So all of these little things that are just serving these human routines, putting stuff out there, making them available for the humans that are no longer in attendance, and then after a while deciding, oh, guess the humans are gone, or guess the routine is over, and it's time to put everything away again.
Yep. Well, it goes ahead and washes the dishes. It starts a fire in the fireplace. And then apparently around 9 o'clock in the evening, the house says, oh, I think it's time to read you poetry, because all smart houses read their inhabitants poetry at 9 p.m. And it goes on to recite the title poem by Sarah Teasdale. And we'll do a little aside on Sarah Teasdale later on.
Right. And again, this is where the title of the story comes from, because the first line is, there will come soft rains and the smell of the ground and swallows circling in their shimmering sound.
Yes. So it plays, or it recites this nice little bit of poetry, and then things start to go awry.
That's right. So the wind kicks up outside, and as a direct result of that, a branch cuts loose from a tree near the house, crashes through the window in the kitchen, and tips over or shatters a bottle of cleaning solution that happens to be on the stove, and apparently the stove is still hot, and boom, it causes a flaming explosion.
And the house, of course, is programmed to handle such eventualities, right? It's got its own little, firefighting robots. It's got its little fire extinguishing mechanisms, but to no avail, because it's used up all of the reserve water supply, so it can't put the fire out. And as the fire rips through the house, all of the remaining automation starts to go haywire. The windows start opening and shutting, and the kitchen starts pushing out, I think it says psychopathically making breakfasts, over and over again. So you imagine, all these crazy automated processes are all trying to kick off at once. Yeah, I imagine that martinis are being poured, and the house is basically, as I said, they do anthropomorphize all the house processes. So it's essentially saying the house is going crazy trying to put the fire out, and it can't do it. Eventually, all these random announcements, all these random processes grind to a halt as the, fire eats through all the guts of the house and melts all the electronics. And, eventually, over the course of the evening, almost the entire house burns down. And the last thing we have when the story ends is the house is stuck once more on its morning announcement, just repeating, today is April 29th, 1985, over and over again. Presumably till its batteries run out.
In the later version, it's today is August 5th, 2026. Today is August 25th, or August 5th, 2026.
Yeah, so you can see that, Bradbury tried to update the story in 1997 to make it a little, I like the original version better. It's much more direct, I think, than the later version. Although the later version, he really changes the writing style with the house especially.
It's almost as if in the time between the two versions of the story, he wants to make some sort of recognition of the development of things like artificial intelligence, and so that it would be more smooth in its operation and more, more anthropomorphized. And, there's also, by the time he does the second version of it, there've been a few automated house kind of stories, or stories that have automated houses in them. I mean, I made reference to the Jeffersons. No, how about the Jetsons? So I made reference to the Jetsons earlier. They're books like...
Was there a Rosie and the Jeffersons too?
Rosie was the robot, yeah. So there was a house computer, and then Rosie was sort of the embodiment of the house's artificial intelligence.
She went around in the Jeffersons, not the Jetsons.
Oh, was... that I don't know. Well, and I was going to say, there are movies, well, a book and then a movie, The Demon Seed, which was about an automated house. There are ones that would have come after, of course. I mean, the whole notion of automated houses or smart houses have become not necessarily ubiquitous, but fairly common these days. I mean, even films like iRobot that came out, from the Asimov story starring Will Smith, he's talking to his house and giving it directions. And I mean, you even go to something like Back to the Future, where Doc Brown has his automation for feeding the dog while he's gone on one of his trips through time.
Right. So you've got all of these different references to home automation. And I swear, although it's so interesting that most automation I see nowadays still depends on the human to do something like these.
Right.
Like, you know, the Philips Hue smart lights, whichever ones they are, the ones you control from your smartphone, right?
Right.
I don't know if they can be programmed to do things at different times, but it seems most of the automation depends on somebody saying, hey, Alexa, do something, or doing something through your phone or your tablet to make your house do things. The idea of the house doing things in a pre-programmed automatic routine just doesn't seem to have happened yet.
Yeah, we tend to take it more as a piece-by-piece kind of thing. So we had a thermostat that was in theory programmable and in practice failed so regularly that we replaced it finally with one that isn't programmable. and we've got those Philips Hue lights and they're interesting. You can put them on timers. You can have them go through different routines through the day, but then you've got to plot it out yourself. Like there's no set routine that you can just run. It's all stuff where you can say, okay, I want it to play this light program at this time of the day. And if you're going to do that, why not just set it up as you were sitting in your living room if you want to change the lighting, change the mood, whatever it is that you want to do.
Yeah, and it sort of presumes that you as a human are following the pre-programmed routine. So,
yes.
So are you going to program the house so that you are basically programming yourself to do things to meet the house's routine? Seems like an odd way to live.
The technology is not necessarily as it was imagined by Bradbury. I suppose it could be, but it would take a lot of effort on our part to set it up to be that way, given the current state of that technology.
Well, needless to say, regardless of whether you're a fan of home automation or not, that is absolutely not the point of this story. I mean, the point of this story, when it was written in 1950, it was a very, very early anti-war, you know, anti-nuclear war specifically warning type of story. And it's really one of the first ones that ever came out, you know, shortly after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki blasts at the end of World War II. And, you know, of course, going into the Cold War and the idea of nuclear annihilation. You know, this was, you know, intended to be one of the very early sort of cautionary tales of, hey, we could really screw this planet up pretty bad. And by the way, we could probably kill all of humanity pretty quickly if we so chose.
So the story frames itself in such a way that we have at odds with one another human ingenuity, the ability to construct a house like this one. A house that is automated to this level, that follows these human routines, that has all of these wonderful little mini technologies like the cleaning robots and the incinerator and the food-o-matic, whatever it is, that spits out breakfast and martinis and so on. So we've got all of this incredible innovation and this capability, this vision to construct this kind of reality. And yet, we're stupid enough as a race that we also have built nuclear bombs. And it doesn't matter how smart we are, we could make it all go away in a blip by starting a nuclear war. So it's just putting those different kinds of innovation, if you will, at odds with one another.
And it's almost like we're treating all the technology as equal, right? The fact that I can set my coffee pot to go off at a certain time is somehow equivalent to, you know, the technology packed into a nuclear warhead, because they, you know, if you deal with enough technology, it just fades into the background and you stop thinking about it. I'm sure the house inhabitants stopped thinking a long time ago about what was actually going on. The house is just doing what it's supposed to do, right? So, of course, the fact that the house can do what it's supposed to do and the nuclear technology that we've invented can destroy everything are almost equivalent. They're just out of sight, out of mind.
Right. They're just different dimensions of the same creative and innovative beings.
And then you get into the fact that another thing the story sort of frames up is this whole conflict between, you know, this technological scientific achievement and the harsh facts of nature, right, and reality. Not that a nuclear war is natural, but fires certainly are. Tree branches falling on buildings are certainly natural. And the fact is that regardless of how great of a structure this is, eventually something's going to go wrong. And nature's going to cause something to happen that's going to cause all this wonderful technology to just turn to dust.
What was the name of that series that came out? It seems like many years ago now. It was something like, was it After Man? That
Life like, After People.
Is that what it was? Okay, there yes. you go. You know, where they're tracing decade by decade or era by era, the slow but inevitable decay of human society, or the evidence of human society, buildings, highways, and so on, as nature slowly reclaims its own.
Yep. There was a book also published on that exact same topic called The World Without Us by an author
that's right.
the name of Weissman, who also covers all that stuff in great detail, though in literary form. I think if I remember correctly, like the last thing that was going to be standing was the Hoover Dam, like for hundreds or thousands of years. That was like going to be the last thing that would be recognizable of humanity. Although with drought out in the West, who knows if that's going to be the case anymore.
Right.
Well, it might be there, just not generating any power.
We clearly have, well, we've created things in different places to be earthquake resistant, depending on the context, or, you know, to stand up to things like hurricanes and so on. But we haven't yet built a structure that's ready to stand up to, well, wildfires, for example, or anything that would be more of just a cataclysm of some sort on a natural scale, or a natural cataclysm on a more epic scale. That's where I'm trying to go with that.
I mean, yeah, this story almost reminds me of some of the pictures that come out, you know, post-hurricane, where there's like the one lone house left standing on the beach, because that's the guy that said, I'm going to not only build according to the local building code, I'm going to hurricane and tsunami-proof my house. And sure enough, you see this like one pretty house standing in this basically field of wreckage and rubble. And I kind of get that picture in my head when I read this story.
Yeah, that's one interesting thing to note, that although we have the shadow of these people that were out playing in the yard when nuclear war struck, we have no sense of anything around. I mean, what that implies is that there was a clear line of sight from the explosion to the wall, so that they were vaporized against their own house. But it kind of implies that there were no houses, or that it wasn't in a neighborhood, or...
I think it actually was in a neighborhood. I think they make reference, at least in my version of the story, to all of the other houses being destroyed except for this one.
Oh, okay. So there's a detail that I
didn't... Which to me means, hey, guess what? These people actually, what did we do? Followed the building codes, which of course also apparently include some type of shielding against EMP radiation. And you know, you would think the electromagnetic pulse coming from the nuclear bomb would have fried all the house electronics, but... Apparently, in the world of 1980 building codes, we shielded all the house electronics from EMP blasts. So, good on the construction crew for putting that little feature in.
They were really thinking ahead.
No, and getting back to the, I think we mentioned the actual title of the story, There Will Come Soft Rains, comes from that poem by Sarah Teasdale. And she actually wrote that after the start of the 1918 German Spring Offensive in World War One, at the same time, the 1918 flu pandemic. Not that we know anything about pandemics nowadays. And she was basically looking at, oh, we've got, you know, the plague trying to kill us. We've got everyone trying to kill each other. And eventually, all of this is going to somehow culminate in the end of the human race, and something is going to show up. There's going to be some kind of new order that is completely indifferent to the outcome of the war or mankind's extinction. And that's why she wrote that very happy poem, basically describing the extinction of the human race.
It's an interesting way to look at the apocalypse, because most post-apocalyptic literature that we have imagines this incredibly dark and horrific existence that makes it super challenging for humans to continue living. But she's like, yeah, but you know what? The planet doesn't care if humans continue to exist. We're going to return to this sort of paradise of reality, because the humans won't be around to fuck everything up anymore.
Well, that was certainly the context of the last story, right? The last flight of Dr. Ain, that
absolutely.
The bears or the other mammals or whatever were just going to take over and go on about their lives like humans never existed. And you're right, this is absolutely the exact same thing. I find it funny that you have all these people, you know, people who talk about the environment, like there's not going to be an environment after nuclear war. There's just going to be a different environment, one that's not particularly suited to humanity.
But I suppose that, you know, a movie with a title like Mad Max is probably going to sell more tickets and to be a much bigger hit than something called Warm and Fuzzy Max.
The Rise of the Bears.
There we go. It's a kinder, gentler apocalypse.
Yeah. It's not Planet of the Apes. It's more of Planet of the Poo.
There we go.
And yes, I do mean Winnie the Pooh.
Where is A.A. Milne when you need him?
Probably not writing stories about the extinction of the human race. I don't really think that was up his alley as a writer. Although it would have been beautifully illustrated if he did.
It sounds like something that would show up on McSweeney's.
So as we mentioned earlier, this is a story that has two different versions, one of which is much more dated than the other. So when we talk about the dated references, Bill, do we start with the earlier story or the second one? I'm not sure how to handle this one.
Well, let's start with the earlier story. I mean, one of the ones that you already called attention to was, well, just the fact that it's set in 1985. And one of the other details that you brought up was the kitchen doors. I suppose the house that I purchased, which is an old farmhouse, or once upon a time it was an old farmhouse, I suppose. Well, actually, once upon a time, it wasn't an old farmhouse.
It was a new old farmhouse.
It is, yeah, you know what I was going for there.
It's got patina.
It did have a kitchen door. That was my point.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, my grandmother's house, which was built in the 1800s, had a swinging door in between the kitchen and the dining room, but it was certainly the case that, you know, the kitchen was where all the dirty, nasty stuff took place, and you didn't want to eat there, so you put a door in between it and the rest of the house. But, you know, every house that I know of with an open floor plan, you know, now everybody goes to the kitchen to hang out and have a good time.
That's right, and I removed that door from my house and put it out in the garage. Well, just, like, stored it, didn't, like, stand, you know, install it in the garage.
Installing your kitchen door in the garage would probably not be a feature that would make your realtor very happy.
No, it would probably have a negative impact on the resale value. So I found it amusing that in both versions of the story, they've got an incinerator in the basement.
Yeah, that's kind of morbid. It's like, what are you doing down there with an incinerator? Right. It's almost like, you know, a Stephen King little detail you throw in there. Oh, and we use this incinerator for, just perfectly normal purposes.
I mean, I suppose you could be dealing with your trash that way, and then technically you would only have ash as your, you know, as your trash.
Oh, so maybe the advanced houses of the futures will have incinerators in their basements, and we just haven't caught up to that future yet.
We could have had it would have been cool to have, you know, a trash cannon and use the chimney to launch your trash into space instead of incinerating it. But that's not in the story.
No, it's not in any story that I've ever even heard of. So
it ought to be.
There you go. There's one you can write for yourself, and
there
we'll see how popular it gets. Maybe some future podcast 100 years from now, we'll be doing the story on Bill Williamson's trash rockets or something like that.
My own little smart house. The little smart house on the prairie. In the early version of it, you made reference to there being film spools and cassette tapes and things like that. That stuff isn't in the version that I was reading.
And the very first part of the story where you talk about the automated voice in the early version, that's done by a phonograph voice.
That's interesting. So does it literally mean like a recorded voice that's on a phonograph or just that style of voice?
I don't know. I've never heard a voice described as a phonograph voice, but maybe it's like a radio voice. No, it can't be. I'm pretty sure it's like an automated record dropping onto a platter and playing.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it says a phonograph voice in the kitchen ceiling.
Oh, that's even stranger.
You know, like I said, the early version and the later version are somewhat different.
I suppose turntables would have been very common items in homes at the time that he was originally writing the story, and by the time he was rewriting the story, phonographs, well, vinyl is a thing of the past. Vinyl is now a thing of nostalgia. That's the better way to put it.
It's the thing of the past that is also the future.
Right. Actually, vinyl outsold CDs last year. I thought that was an interesting change.
Oh, yeah, because everything's online now. It's all streaming.
That's right. And so if you're going to go nostalgia value, you're going to go old school. You're not going to go, you know, mid-school.
I'm going to buy myself a phonograph and start ripping CDs again like it's 1991.
Yeah, but who's going to bring back 8-track tapes? So that's what I want to know.
I'm sure there's a dedicated Kickstarter project out there that is doing that exact same thing.
Well, Dan, we seem to be veering off the rails a little more than usual with this one. So why don't we rein it in by coming back to our now world-famous scale. What the fuck? Where does this fall for you?
That's interesting because it's definitely, it's almost like a, really, humans? That's what you did? Come on, man. I mean, you read the story and it's, again, there's no characters, right? There's no real drama. It's just basically the description of a device doing something, which by itself isn't really any of those. It's not a a whoa or what the fuck, but you have to start thinking about the larger context of, all these arcs and themes we mentioned before about, humanity developing technology and developing technology that we use to destroy ourselves, and the idea of, the things we invent and the technologies we deploy just carrying on as if we were never there in their mindless automated way. So there's a lot of to contemplate when you think about the context of the story, but the story itself, I wouldn't say is a really, doesn't really elicit a a whoa or a what the fuck when I read it.
For me, it isn't the contents of the story. It's more the idea of the story that elicits a woe from me. Because my first impression when I reread it, I remember reading the story from many, many years ago. And when I reread it, I'd forgotten that this was the story that went with that title initially. And I was like, whoa, oh yeah, that's right. He did a story where there were no human characters in it. Well, where there are no characters in it. The house is the context. It is the setting, it is the antagonist, not the antagonist, the setting, the house is the protagonist, the house is the setting for the story. I thought that was really cool in and of itself, because when it was originally done, that would have been a fairly innovative thing to do, and there is a little bit of a woe factor for that, but it's more for the author's initiative that he takes rather than for the story itself or the contents of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I first read this story, it was probably in that publication of the Martian Chronicles, and my first thought is, man, this is depressing. I wasn't thinking about the author. I wasn't thinking about how he was writing the story. I just read it, and I'm like, man, this is just, not good.
Well, and that exactly is the thread that caused us to slip it in at this point in the podcast. The most recent stories that we've been doing have had that kind of apocalyptic arc to them. And we're going to carry that theme on. We'll get back to that in a moment. But this definitely fits right in with this little doom and gloom arc that we're on lately.
Yeah, we've pretty much covered, I think the first stories were, a natural event or a couple natural events, right? The pale of air was the earth getting torn away from the sun. The inconstant moon was the solar flare, and then we had Dr. Ain. We transitioned from natural causes to man-made causes, right, where Dr. Ain goes and kills everybody off but saves the environment or something similar to our environment. And then we wrap up with this one, which is, man-made destruction of not only ourselves but presumably the rest of the planet as well. So, yeah, we've pretty much covered all of them.
Yep, we have Ray Bradbury describing the world that is left for Keith Richards and the cockroaches.
Yeah, it's funny you talk about the cockroaches. There was another short story I remember reading about a couple of people who invent something that can reach into the future and grab objects, although they don't really know what they're going to bring back. But they end up bringing back this statue of a figure holding the earth, over its head and just symbolizing the triumph of its race. And it's a cockroach.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a real twist on something like the Planet of the Apes. Planet of the Cockroaches.
They will inherit the Earth. So for our next episode, we're going to go a little bit past the post-apocalyptic world into a rather interesting one that has no, well, no real humans, but things that want to be human, and that would be Roger Zelazny's classic, For a Breath I Tarry.
It's a cool one, and you're going to want to come back to hear us chatting about it.